The views expressed in the following program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Key Biscayne Independent or Miami 4th Estate. Portions were pre-recorded.
And again, I think of Al, I think of you, and I want to love you. You will always be my friend, though.
Live from Key Biscayne, Florida, this is Antisocial, the podcast that gets into the dirt with social media, wrestles around, and brushes the dust off. I'm Tony Winton.
I'm John Pacenti.
Well, we're back after a two-week break. Did you miss us? You were covering a big sea level rise vote, right?
Yeah.
Was it longer than normal? Because I really was on a different continent.
Yes, it was longer than normal. I think it might have set a record for length.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a plan to get you like a hotel room.
Yeah.
But it didn't work out too well.
No.
No. Next time.
I love I-95 too much.
Okay. Well, we'll get into why I wasn't here in the second segment.
Right.
It's a continental story.
Well, it's like 2024 is just starting off with a bang news-wise. I mean, there's just been an avalanche of news, and
it is, and it piles up when you're out. And today, as we're getting ready to do this podcast on a very important topic, we have arguably the most important legal case in the history of the United States Supreme Court unfolding, and we'll get to that in a moment as well. But I don't want to delay our guests any further.
Yes. Today, our guests are two reporters from the Miami Herald who rocked this island with their stories on accusations against gymnast coach Oscar Aliyah. The accusations, some of which are more than a decade old, came on the heels of an arrest of a Key Biscayne attorney, William McCann Jr., on child porn charges.
Yeah, it has the community on edge. We've reported on how local officials here in Key Biscayne are expressing confidence in the police department, but there is a growing call for a public town hall on the matter. So our guests
are Anna Claudia Jacine and Clara Sophia Daly. Anna Claudia is a data reporter for the Herald and El Nuevo Herald and has pursued investigative reporting from the time she was a graduate student, correct?
Correct.
At American University. And Clara Sophia is an investigative reporter fellow at the Miami Herald, and she has a master's degree from Columbia University. That's some pedigree.
Right. And we should also note that we did invite the chief of police, Frank Sousa, to be on the program today, and he declined. He said he was under the weather.
He is under the weather.
But we did extend an invitation to him.
So first, thanks for your work on this subject. Let's bring listeners up to speed. Tell us how you got to the story and what you've uncovered and where the story is going.
All right. So we have reported on gymnastics coach Oscar Aliyah, who has been accused of sexually assaulting students of his and other minors over the past decade or so. There is two recent allegations. One, an allegation into a 7-year-old whose parents say Aliyah touched and spoke to inappropriately. And then another recent allegation into a 4-year-old student of his who his mom, her mom also says was touched and spoken to inappropriately. There are also 3 allegations from previous times, including an allegation that a 13-year-old student of his at the time was touched inappropriately and sexually assaulted during private gymnastics lessons. And another allegation that a 17-year-old girl who was a student of Aliyah's was raped by him. There also was another incident in a police report, basically, that shows that there was an 18-year-old girl who was found with Aliyah intoxicated in Key Biscayne. And she says that she had sexual relations with Aliyah while she was underage.
From 16 years old.
So we need to tell the listeners that Oscar Aliyah has not been charged. He wasn't investigated with these recent round of complaints. And both the Miami-Dade Special Victims Unit and the state attorney's office said there wasn't enough to charge him with the crime. Can you share with us the impact on these young women? And I mean, these are really devastating reports, especially the ones from, you know, a decade ago.
Yeah,
correct. Yeah. And these women, you know, spoke to us, the ones from the past specifically, and they told us, you know, what had happened to them. There were police reports from the time, from the 13-year-old. Her mom had taken her to the police station back in 2014 and taken these letters that she found that were allegedly from Olea, two of them, and one of them as a response from her to him. The letters detailed, it says that him kissing her while she was 14 at the time her mother took her to the police, but this started before. And after speaking to us and seeing the story, they decided it was time to go back to the police and tell them the full extent of what had happened, as they told us.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you looked into the statute of limitations here, or any, you know, is there any effect on these older cases? Can the police open up the cases? Can, you know, charges be brought?
Mm-hmm. It's our understanding that specifically with the 13-year-old, the statute of limitations is on her side because she was under 16 when this happened. And so she still has a case there. The other ones might still have civil cases, but maybe not criminal. But I would assume the police would still take their, you know, their allegations seriously and maybe use it as part of the case.
In your discussions with the young women and their families, did you get the impression that they felt they weren't taken seriously by investigators here?
It's still kind of in process right now, right? Just last week, two of these women went back to the police department and had conversations. You know, the police department in Key Biscayne says that they are investigating and that once they gather enough evidence, they will again take the investigation to the state attorney's office. So, you know, it's not really clear. One of the women felt a little bit that the police department was only focused on the night that she was found intoxicated, which we reported on. And she wanted to also tell the police about the other sexual relations that she had when she was underage with Olea. But the police were really focused on the night she was intoxicated. So she felt frustrated by that. But overall, the police did hear them out. And only time will tell exactly, you know, what happens and whether or not Olea is charged.
And in the cases from the past, the mother that spoke to the chief press back then was a bit frustrated. However, she never made an official complaint. It was just a conversation with him. She didn't want to file an official report, but she still feels a little bit like he could have done more.
That, and that's, I guess, the older cases is somewhat difficult because Mr. Olea had a relationship with the Village of Key Biscayne Community Center. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of athletic providers there who help people on the gym equipment. There's spinning classes. It's a standard kind of thing you'd see at a lot of community centers, and they rely on these third-party vendors to come in. And I guess what we had sort of gotten the impression is because it was not a direct complaint, it was sort of no formal complaint was made, the village officials felt at the time they didn't have any reason to act.
Yeah. Just to be super clear on what happened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oscar Olea used to work for American Gymsters, which is a contractor for the Key Biscayne Parks and Recreation Department. He was an employee of American Gymsters. During that time, an employee for the Key Biscayne Parks and Recreation Department saw him carrying a girl around his waist inappropriately and felt that it was inappropriate and asked the owner of American Gymsters to fire him. So that was a direct complaint that was seen. After he was fired from coaching for American Gymsters, just a couple years later, he was given a permit to coach in the Village Green. And so he continued to coach gymnastics despite a complaint against him while he was working at American Gymsters for the Key Biscayne Parks and Recreation Department.
At the same time, when the mother comes to speak to Chief Press about her daughter allegedly being raped, Chief Press says he went to the director of the Parks and Rec Department and spoke to him about it. And the permit came after that conversation. But, you know, the director says now there wasn't anything official. There wasn't anything I can do. I gave him the permit.
Mm-hmm. Now, These complaints from 2012, about different time, right?
Correct.
Before Epstein, before Nassar, before anything, before women thought they could come forward and be heard. So do these victims now feel that you know feel more comfortable coming forward? Is that because it's a different time that we've made it priority to listen to these women?
Absolutely. Not only is it a different time, but they're older, right? Now these people who were sexually assaulted when they were 13 years old are my age. They're 26. They are mothers. They have children. They, you know, understand that this is a pattern that's continuing on, and they feel a sense of responsibility to speak out. So I think that there definitely has been a cultural shift, but, regardless, these are serious allegations and something that any police department, you know, the victims feel should take seriously.
We have a bunch of more questions because it's, as I said, it's now spun out into other aspects of what's going on in Key Biscayne. We will be back right after this. Key Biscayne, island paradise. Key Biscayne, island paradise.
And we go down the trails to the north point of the Bear Cut Bridge.
I'm John Pacenti.
I'm Tony Winton, and you're back on Antisocial.
And we're talking to the reporters who broke the story about Oscar Alia, gymnastic coach on Key Biscayne. Five victims that we know of have come forward with allegations against Mr. Alia, who has not been charged with the crime. We'll start off with that. Is this the first time you guys really got to know Key Biscayne, or did you have some roots here?
I actually went to Coral Gables High School in the IB program. A lot of my friends lived in Key Biscayne, so I spent a lot of time in high school on the Key, and I know it pretty well.
Yes, there was a whole contingent of people who got up at like 6 in the morning to ride the bus at the yep. Coral Gables High. Go Cavs, right?
Go Cavs.
Why did you decide to dive into this story?
Decided to dive into this story initially because the allegations were serious. And also one of the reasons I think I was assigned the story is because I was a competitive figure skater growing up. And my editor understands that, you know, as a competitive athletes, there can be really close relationships between athletes and coaches. And, you know, we weren't sure initially whether or not these allegations were credible. That was something we had to look into. But once I found these old police reports, especially the love letters between the 13-year-old and Oscar Alia, where, you know, she says, "I want to please you the way you please me," and these kinds of things about kissing on the lips that seem so specific, I felt like it was a really important story to pursue.
Right. And beyond the impact of the story, because it's now, it comes on the heels, we mentioned at the beginning of the top of the show, it comes on the heels of an FBI investigation, which led to felony federal charges against an attorney, William McCaughan Jr. That case appears headed to a plea bargain or plea deal sometime in this month, actually. And it involved a case arising out of Texas, where you have child sexual abuse material that involved cell phone transmission, allegedly. And that had happened again in July. It was the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI don't normally put information out about arrests, but it came out again, and I point out from the Miami Herald initially, about a disbarment proceeding that in front of the Florida Supreme Court. Mr. McCaughan Jr. has remained in custody the entire time, but that incident and your reporting has kind of raised the tension level here in Key Biscayne. There's a petition. I think it has 400 or 500 signatures on it.
I haven't checked recently.
Yes, it's gaining steam, there are people who are concerned. Have you seen this happen in other communities where it's something like this in a small? Do we have a small town environment here? You're familiar with Key Biscayne. It's really. Have you seen that kind of reaction?
In Key Biscayne, it's certainly more concentrated because it's such a small community, and you know, people feel like, you know, they let their kids go to school riding their bikes, on their scooters, walking to school. They feel that it's a safe place for them to raise their kids. And so I think that's why, you know, there's so much buzz around it right now. And there's these petitions to try to get some clarity from police and the village itself.
Right.
You spoke about that you were a competitive figure skater. So you know about coaches. Parents trust these coaches implicitly. And now they're wondering, certainly here on Key Biscayne, should I be so trusting of these individuals? Are you guys looking in your reporting at all on, you know, what parents can do to protect their children?
I mean, speaking to parents, right? Other parents have different ideas of like what they feel comfortable with and what they do not feel comfortable with. But we spoke to multiple parents who had heard rumors and because of the rumors decided to stay during their children's gymnastics lessons to watch with their own eyes and make sure that he wasn't doing anything that they felt uncomfortable with. I've also spoken to parents who have had to have really uncomfortable conversations with their children, even kids as young as, you know, 4, 5 years old, 6 years old, asking them, hey, have you ever felt uncomfortable by your coach? So I think that from what I've heard from parents, it's a lot of conversations around, you know, whether or not I feel comfortable dropping my children off and leaving them at class, and also just asking their children and having open conversations about actions.
And in terms of like a follow-up more on a community basis, not specifically these cases, is there a protocol that's best practices for this kind of situation to give both the students and their parents some safety assurances?
Vetting,
and then monitoring.
I mean, the U.S. Department of Safe Sport does, you know, create some guidelines for coaches in different sports. They apparently have an investigation into Oscar Olea. We don't have any updates on that as of now. I can't give parents advice. I think it's, you know, really up to every individual parent to figure out.
These are sports where there's physical. The coach has to sometimes touch someone's body. I mean, it's just the gymnastics, especially, right? So what is the protocol?
Says that he had a female coach present at all times, and I guess the surveillance tape, he used the surveillance tape to defend himself that didn't show any, you know, untoward behavior.
That's what the police say. They reviewed that tape.
Yeah. Right. I think it was like a very specific day and specific time.
And provided by the defense attorney.
Correct.
So the question now is, as these cases have unfolded, as if past as prologue, is there going to be more victims coming forward?
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know. You know, experts have told us that it's likely they will, but we honestly don't know.
As a reporter covering these cases are very hard. How's it affected you? I mean, has it changed how you view journalism or?
Yeah, I mean, I entered these conversations with a lot of empathy and understanding. One of the alleged victims, you know, I was the first person she really spoke to openly about this. She had told her husband, for example, sort of that something had happened, but not the details. And I was the first person that she really opened up to about these details. And it was difficult to hear. But at the end of the day, you know, I was glad that I could be there to listen to what she had to say. And, you know, I think that there was a sense of justice that she felt in telling her story and knowing that she wasn't alone and that there were other people who had similar experiences. She wasn't just unlucky.
Yeah. And at the same time, you know, it's hard for us to hear these things, but it's much harder for them to be telling us. And so I think keeping that in the back of our minds and how important this reporting is and how it will affect a lot of people, you know, is a driving force here.
I want to thank both of you for coming onto our program, Clara Sophia Daly and Anna Claudia Chassin. Both from Miami Herald broke this story, and we'll be watching your work as well. We'll continue to report on it in the Key Biscayne Independent. And again, thank you for coming on our show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
And we go down the trails to the north point of the Bear Cut Bridge. As the sand flies itching your head as you return back home.
And we're back on Antisocial. I'm Tony Winton.
I'm still John Pisani.
You're still John Pisani.
Yes, I am.
Does it ever change?
If I'm at home, I'm Johnny.
Oh, okay.
I'm back with my family.
Yes. Well, that was a very heavy segment, but a necessary one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this story has, like, as we said, has rocked the island. It has sparked a petition, and it's not going away. There's going to be public comment at the next village council meeting, and the village manager has said he is open to a town hall. So
right, and so we'll see. Apparently, Chief Sousa. I mean, one of the limitations, of course, is going to be anything that's an active criminal investigation. Is difficult for any kind of law enforcement person to speak. And you and I both know that talking to law enforcement agencies over our careers and Key Biscayne is no different.
Well, one of the parts of the story, and we kind of touched on it, is there is a political aspect to this. Many of the people who are, raising concern have in the past, lambasted the elected officials who are currently on the dais, as well as the village staff. And, and then there's this other, there's the more extremists, the QAnon crowd. This is like catnip to them. So they're using it as a right. political
crutch. But not to minimize the gravity and the seriousness of what's happened here. And people have asked me, what's your take on this? And I go, I've lived here for really since I got about 20 years now, and Key Biscayne has changed even in that period a great deal. Transitioning from a mixture of a bedroom community and a lot of snowbirds to really a dynamic community with young families and more than just a bedroom community. It really has grown a lot, and at the same time, it is not it's a physical island, but it is not a cultural island. And I think there was a belief by some that this was a super special place and the normal rules of politics and physics didn't seem to apply to Key Biscayne. And that just isn't true. It's an affluent community. It's a well-educated community. It has a lot of great things going for it. But these are national trends, and we've had it in some of our reporting about exploitation and child abuse, and these extend to not just that, domestic violence, substance abuse. There are a raft of societal problems that Key Biscayne is not immunized from. And, a halcyon era of the 1970s, perhaps, where people keep looking back to this idyllic community where this kind of stuff didn't happen. Well, I think history would tend to disagree with that. It was maybe suppressed and kept swept under the rug, but I'm not sure that that's true either. What you're seeing now is a more obviously and more directly visible kind of clash of these various problems in our community.
Yeah, I mean, the chief says that, it's an idyllic place, Key Biscayne, but it's not immune to some of the more dangerous individuals that lurk in our society. I mean, it's not there. I mean, it can't be. It's an island of 15,000 residents. I mean, that's a sizable
15,000 residents and up to 1 million visitors.
Yeah. I mean, things are going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, but there's points to be made, should he have been allowed to teach on the village green? There was anecdotal evidence, anecdotal evidence is enough to make changes
and it's fit for a policy review, right? And I think you're going to see calls for that, and it's something about how vetting, particularly the vetting that you mentioned, and whether there should be standards that are applied, or whether it's just, hey, anybody who can come in and fill out a business license can get approved to do something.
Well, I asked Mayor Roscoe that, and he said he thinks that the policies that are in place are adequate now, but if a review is necessary, he's open to it.
All right. Well, we'll be back with the next segment of our show.
Gotcha.
In just a moment.
This is John Pisani.
And I'm Tony Winton. You're back on Antisocial.
Well, Tony, I guess you kind of went to the ends of the earth.
Well, I did. I kind of got away from things. Instead of village council debates, I heard something else. Yeah, that's a king penguin.
I don't know. It sounds like the village council to me.
Well, I don't know. I couldn't really make out. It was really just one person making a lot of noise in this gaggle of, I guess there were about 1,000 penguins.
Again, it sounds like a village council meeting.
Well, let's hear it again. I don't know. Yeah.
We'll leave it to our readers to decide which penguin would be on the island
here. I don't know. I was thinking of making it my ringtone. that was from the Falkland Islands. Which is, you know, it was a really amazing trip. And I was, you know, sorry, I'm not going to apologize for missing that long council meeting and all this other breaking news. Just needed to take a break for a while. But it was a trip to there and Antarctica
and Argentina
and icebergs. And, we saw humpback whales, we saw orcas, we saw dolphins, and I mentioned the penguins, and not just the ones on the land here. They were, what's really amazing, seeing them in the water, because they were actually diving, paralleling us, and how fast and nimble they are in the water. They're like rockets.
It's amazing evolution.
Well, they look like very comical kind of figures on land, but in the water, you know, I wouldn't want to be on the business end of a penguin with its beak. If you're a fish, no way.
Well, you did miss an interesting long council meeting in which they kind of approved the next step in the big dig.
Yeah, I saw that. So they approved part of the work order, but holding back on the other part of the work order.
Yeah, you know, so they can do, some of the designs that needs to be done to get it to 100%, but they haven't decided exactly what the service that they want and how much they want to pay. So I guess it's going to next month. I think it's the 20th, March 20th. I might be incorrect there. They're going to hold another workshop, and they're going to decide how much money they want to spend on this thing.
Right. And it seems to be a collision between the professional engineering advice and some members of the council just think that number is too big.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm just reading between the lines. It's like this system, we're designing the system to meet this level of potential rain. We don't know how bad it's going to be. Anything less than this would be a mistake.
Well, one of the big, and I met with, the village manager on this before this meeting. And the big thing is that the system that's going to cost $248 million is easily upgradable. You know, it can be nimble as sea level rise increases or, you know, bigger storms. If you go down below, 1.8 inches per hour removing water, then it becomes, you might have to replace it like in a decade or a couple decades.
Right. But the idea, as I understand the argument, is that once the pipes are in the ground, that is a constraining factor. You can switch out a higher intensity pump,
right?
That can get more pump more water through the pipes. But if the pipes are too small to accommodate the pump, then you've kind of blocked your way of upgrading, because that it puts a limitation on the amount of water you can move.
I mean,
so if you're going to save money, build a bigger pipe and get a smaller pump. And then if the situation doesn't warrant an upgrade, you just replace it with the same type of pump, because they'll eventually fail and have to be replaced anyway. And if the rainfall and the flooding is worse than expected, then you have the ability to get a larger pump and move more water.
And another thing that would, if you want to cut costs, the dissipators, which is like a shower head where all the water is sprayed into the bay, would be smaller and less effective. The village staff and the engineers and the village manager believes that the Key Biscayne needs a system that can last for decades, that can be upgradable, and it's either like, you know, pay now or pay later. It's, you know, that's, well, pay more later.
Yes, yeah. Pay now or pay more later. Or, and the other argument, which we should not give short shrift to, which is live with rising water.
Yes.
Live with it.
Right.
Right? That means building house on stilts, right? And other kinds of things. It's shifting the burden from the government to the property owners and say, hey, look, you know, if things get bad, you're going to have, you should assume the roads are going to flood more often and be ready for it. That's Councilmember Moss's, yes, makes the snowfall analogy over and over again. You know, maybe we should get someone on from the Buffalo City Council to ask him
about that. Yeah. I mean, here's one thing, Tony, that Rasko had the votes, you know, but he's trying to build consensus and, you know, goodwill as going forward into this election.
Correct. It's an election year. He's announced he's running for reelection. We mentioned on the earlier part of the show, we have three seats up. And just one potential incumbent who is not decided yet whether he's going to run again, Frank Kaplan. So that's a big question out there. And it's a presidential election year, so it's going to be a jammed thing. Speaking of presidential election year.
Oh, my God.
Did you see how I weaved that in?
Great segue,
that was a
Tony.
Great segue. That's it.
Better than my awkward segues.
We mentioned at the top of the show that today is, you know, I thought covering Bush v. Gore, you know, and here in Florida, because I was like probably the height of the most insane presidential election I'd ever covered.
It was crazy.
Right. That was the 2000. I was in Nashville, Tennessee. I was a traveling reporter for the Associated Press, and I was in Nashville with the Gore campaign. And it's, you know, the polls have closed, and I'm on the phone with Terry Spencer in the Miami Bureau, and there's no call. The AP didn't call the race.
Right.
Right. And one of the people, turns out, just passed, who was responsible for that call, Will Lester, just passed away.
Yes.
Making that decision to not make a call, the correct decision, because it was 500 and whatever, 30 votes or something. I forget the exact number. But that was the peak of, I thought, would be, how could there ever be a presidential election contest that went all the way to the Supreme Court? How could that ever, what would top it? Well, we have something topping it today. Here is Jonathan Mitchell, a lawyer for former President Donald Trump, arguing this morning in the U.S. Supreme Court.
President Trump is not covered by Section 3 because the president is not an officer of the United States, as that term is used throughout the Constitution. Officer of the United States refers only to appointed officials, and it does not encompass elected individuals such as the president or members of Congress.
Wow, that's some argument, man.
Right. That's the argument. We're talking about a, up until now, pretty obscure provision of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, passed after the Civil War.
Right.
That prevents people who engage in insurrection or rebellion and who also swore an oath to preserve the Constitution, cannot serve in a bunch of offices unless Congress gives them a pass, which it did after the Civil War. A few years after that amendment was adopted by the states, part of the Constitution, the Congress did, in fact, basically pass an almost blanket amnesty for a lot of former Confederates and allowed them to work, you know, run for the school board, because really any office. Any office anywhere, not just that was the intention. And as an act of trying the country together, the Congress did, more with some exceptions, did basically agree to that. But it didn't apply going forward. And so now we are in 2024.
Yes.
And here's the argument from Jason Murray, the attorney for a group of Colorado voters, Republicans, who asked the Colorado state court system to invalidate Mr. Trump's run in the primary, and they succeeded. The Colorado Supreme Court put it on hold pending this argument today in front of the Supreme Court. Here's what Jason Murray had to say.
President Trump's main argument is that this court should create a special exemption to Section 3 that would apply to him and to him alone. He says Section 3 disqualifies all oath-breaking insurrectionists except a former president who never before held other state or federal office. There is no possible rationale for such an exemption. and the court should reject the claim that the framers made an extraordinary mistake.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court is in kind of a pickle here. Are they going to adhere to the Constitution, or are they going to adhere to the man who appointed how many? Four of them? Three of them?
I believe it was three.
Yeah. I don't know. It's all very beleaguering right now on the Democratic front. I mean, it's a lot, you know, a lot is happening. I mean, last week? Was it the first appellate court, was it? Or the appellate ruled?
D.C. Circuit.
Yeah, the D.C. Circuit. Thanks, Tony. Ruled that, you know, Trump was not immune from prosecution because, you know, that he was arguing that because he was president, he could do anything.
Yeah. Well, it was trying to expand an existing principle in the law of kind of based in it. It's something called sovereign immunity, and he was the executive, and it kind of applies in civil cases, and there's a limited form of that he was saying, hey, listen, it should also apply to when you're the president of the United States. It really needs to be total immunity, even for criminal prosecutions, and it needs to exist even after you've left office, and that's what the court rejected.
Yeah. I mean, Tony, I mean, I look at big picture here. There's a lot of signs that democracy is on the ropes. I mean, we have this crystal fascist as a House speaker right now. I mean, I don't think you can argue any other way. That's what he is. And I'm pretty sure that he's going to insert himself into the next election, and we might have a problem certifying it, and the election deniers will be...
Well. I will point out, though, that people may have forgotten that last year the Congress did pass a change to the Electoral Count Act that was a bipartisan group that was to make some serious changes to the law that was in effect when the electoral votes are counted. That law has been updated. A lot of loopholes were closed. So I guess some people would argue that some of the opportunities for monkey business have been removed because that language has been tightened up. And that did pass, and it's now law.
What about these alternative slates? That's what it addressed, right, Tony?
Well, I mean, yeah, clarifying what it is that the Congress is doing. Is the job of the Congress to conduct an investigation into the legitimacy of the slates that are presented? Or is it just a mechanical... Hey, these are the slates that came in. I'm just supposed to count them, and that's it. And what we saw on January 6th was an attempt. This is the core of Jack Smith's case, was an attempt to impede this process by not having the votes counted at that stage, and perhaps lead to some kind of constitutional crisis. That would somehow. The theory being Mr. Trump would stay in office in some way. And that is the insurrection. That is the heart of what we're dealing with. And if you read the Colorado opinion in this case, that's what there was a trial. There was Mr. Trump was able to participate. There was a factual determination by a trial court. And then she didn't feel that Mr. Trump, as the argument you just heard, was not an officer as defined by that particular provision in the Constitution. So although the factual evidence was there, he didn't fit the definition, and the Colorado Supreme Court reversed her and said, no, he is an officer, and therefore, since you now have the factual predicate that's been confirmed, we're going to strike him from the ballot. But that's the Supreme Court's got to weigh in on this one. So that's where we're at today. And it's really, you know— it's a very divisive question, not only because the country is divided, but just looking at it, there are people who say, really, this is, we don't want the courts to stop this political process from happening. The Supreme Court might have a legal reason to do so, but it's in the overall best interest of the country to just let the election go forward. And that's a not even really a completely legal argument. It was more of like a policy argument. And what will the Supreme Court do? Hard to know.
Yes, it's hard to know.
Yeah. I can only, again, you know, what is, it would be unusual, I think, for the court to make such a dramatic ruling when there are opportunities for it to find an off-ramp.
What are those off-ramps, Tony?
Well, one of them is that not so much this argument that the Trump attorney was making, that the language doesn't apply to the president. I mean, they could easily find it does apply to the president, but that there's no mechanism for Congress, right? And I think in some of the questioning, at least some of it I heard before we started the show this afternoon, was that some of the justices were zeroing in on that. The language is kind of silent as to, well, who's supposed to make that call? Is it the states? Is it the Congress? Is it somebody else? Is it the courts? There's no, the question is, they would call, is it self-enforcing? And there isn't a lot of precedent on how that provision has been used. There are some people decades ago who were barred from holding office or removed from office by courts. That happened, but never of a federal officer and certainly never a president. So that's the question. The court could say, hey, look, Congress needs to address this about removing someone in a federal office, and they can pass a statute. We're not, it's not up to us to figure out something that they had the ability to fix. So they could essentially duck it.
Well, then they would be, you know, hypocrites, because they're all, you know, more than half of them are originalists, right?
Yeah, and they think that's the counter-argument. The counter-argument is the language says what it says. It says if you did this, you're not eligible. You're not eligible if you're over 35. Under 35, you're not eligible if you have already served two terms as president. Barack Obama, not eligible.
Yeah, I mean, if you...
I mean, there are eligibility provisions in the Constitution that don't have the specific, doesn't say, and Congress shall decide whether a president has served more than one term, two terms. I mean, it's... This is one of these, you know, it's these legal reasoning. And as I said, as a political matter, I find it really hard for the Supreme Court to say, we're going to kick this guy off the ballot or enable states to keep him off the ballot, which would be what Colorado has done. It's up to each state to decide that we're not going to interfere. There's no reason for us to interfere in this decision. That would be the originalist
right
viewpoint. That's what Judge Michael Luttig has said, and others have argued. That's the standard way do it. But I just can't see the court doing it.
I'm just skeptical. If they find that he is not an officer of the United States, I think that is one more step towards authoritarianism, and it's a really bad sign. Another bad sign.
Right. We will. And then the next question is when we will have a decision. Right? Do they decide right away? Bush versus Gore took about a week, right? That was a nutty week. What's going to happen?
It was so nutty.
You know,
bringing back, I can't, you know, that was 24 years ago, man. I can't believe it.
Right. And I was, you know, that was one of those things where, you know, your life just, what's going on?
It was all you did. I mean, nobody got any sleep. I mean, it was one of those. I mean, we had a political reporter at the Palm Beach Post that, we had to like almost tranquilize him to get him down after 24 days.
Right. And people forget all the crazy lawsuits. That was just one of the lawsuits. Right. There were lawsuits about in almost every county about absentee voters. And I mean, there was just all this because everyone, you know, like you find 10 votes to keep them on or keep them off or kick them. It was just, I don't know. There must have been at one point a dozen lawsuits pending.
Were you at the Miami-Dade clerk's office, not the election office, when the mini riot kind of took place?
No. I wasn't there. By that point, I was already in Tallahassee.
Oh.
Because we knew that eventually it was going to go to the Florida Supreme Court. So we were, when the final decision in Bush versus Gore came down, I was in Tallahassee when that happened. Yeah. So,
okay.
All right. Well, that's going to fill out our show for today. And we had a bunch of other things to talk about, but it's already 44 minutes into the show.
Yeah, we'll catch you up on our next show. There's plenty of things happening. We're covering a lot of different aspects, and there's going to be a lot of good news in the Key Biscayne Independent, which, of course, we rely on donors.
Right. Donor support, really important. And that is how we plan to expand and have hyperlocal news in other communities. And so, you know, and I hope people will see like this, the Miami Herald, we had two of our reporters who I know, Anna Claudia from years back, but the journalism is these days kind of like a collegial there's fewer and fewer of us doing this job. So we're in the nonprofit side, and your dollars are really sorely needed. So please, kbindependent.org, and every gift is appreciated.
And, you know, donate, and you'll get our news. You'll get into our site, right?
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
I'm Tony Winton.
John Pisani.
Take care, everyone. In your head as you return back home, and then the next day you say you wanna go for a ride. I'm with my baby, my honey, we're gonna watch the sunset.